I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. We talked about China a few months back, but specifically about their strategy with their airspace. We've been writing quite a bit lately, Jim, about their building up of their surface forces, their naval forces. What is their long-term strategy there, and what are they working on?
Well, there's interesting insights coming out of China on that. Recently, in the last year, China has gone through a fairly significant reorganization with the military and the military-civilian leadership. As we pointed out in Strategy Page, in China, being basically a clone of the old Soviet Union, the politicians, who are all members of the Communist Party of China, mandate that the military officers swear allegiance to the Communist Party, not to China. In other words, the Communist Party, and they learned this from the Russians, from the Soviets, they maintained their police state for so long by centralizing all power. In other words, they didn't bother with, you know, patriotism. You know, in most countries, democracies, you know, you pledge allegiance to the country. You know, and everybody's a civil servant. Not the case in the communist countries, especially China. All power is to the people, and the people are represented by the self-appointed, you know, leaders of the Communist Party. That has come under attack within China. Not direct attack, but, you know, they do a lot of polling, and they've noticed that their officers no longer, you know, automatically subscribe to the idea that all power to the, you know, the leaders of the Communist Party. A lot of them are basically talking dangerous talk about being loyal to China, which is a no-no. So what that comes to with the Navy and the military in general is that open discussions within China over this issue, and they will discuss these things openly, because again, they recognize that secrecy is great, but if you really want to get all angles out there where people can, you know, study them, you got to have an open discussion. The Russians did that, the Soviets did that as well. What they realized was there's a lot of confusion within the military about who's in charge. And this was one reason behind the last year, the reorganization of the, I think it was six different Coast Guards. They had, you know, maritime police type operations into one China Coast Guard. And we just did an article recently about how they've now ordered a 12,000 ton warship, or patrol ship as they call it. You know, and that's a big mystery, because they didn't say, we know it's building, we know it's for the Coast Guard, but we don't know what it's going to be carrying. I mean, you can carry a lot in a 12,000-ton ship. They just launched a 4,000-ton patrol ship, which is the size of a frigate, and they've got more of those on the way. So what we pointed out in our article, a recent article on the Chinese Coast Guard, is that their Coast Guard now is larger than their Navy was 30 years ago, when it was mostly coastal, you know, patrol boats and what have you, and a few old, you know, World War II type, you know, warships. So they, in fact, have two navies. Their regular Navy is building all kinds of ships, but it's still, again, we did a recent article on this. We pointed out that it's still nowhere near the United States, especially the United States and its allies in East Asia, you know, Taiwan, and especially Japan and South Korea. They have very, very modern, well-trained, deadly navies. China has the numbers, but they still don't have the quality. And again, pointing out, and I've had discussions, I'll dig up some interesting stuff on the boards he follows, from American officers, naval officers, commenting on how the Chinese are still Bush League. I mean, they are spending more time at sea, but not nearly as much as the United States or most Western navies or the South Koreans or the Japanese. And if it came to a fight, they would probably get shut down real quick. Now, the media loves to make a lot of noise about their their DF-21, you know, carrier-seeking ballistic missile and all sorts of wonder weapons. But, you know, even the Chinese haven't announced, you know, putting that weapon into service yet. It's still, quote, in development. We know what that means. We call it development hell. And that's where a lot of their weapons are. They still, the media, American media, for example, we're talking about China this year is going to send their SSBN, you know, their ballistic missile carrying nuclear submarine, on cruises in the Eastern Pacific so they can threaten, you know, Eastern United States. Well, the thing is, and we pointed this out, they haven't done it yet, and they've never done it. They've had SSBNs for two decades, and they've never sent one out on a cruise, on an actual combat cruise. So they've been in development hell for over two decades with, you know, SSBN, something we've had for over 50 years, and the Russians have had for over 40 years. So they still have a way to go, and the big thing that we've uncovered recently is that there is no, you know, smart guy in the middle or at the top, as it were, you know, putting together a strategy which directs all of their naval efforts at a single particular goal. All they're really doing now, which is of concern to the United States and most of our allies in Eastern Asia, is their attempt to basically gain sovereignty over the South China Sea and a bunch of other disputed islands or what have you. The Chinese, again, probably not deliberately, because anybody can say anything in China, relatively speaking. Some Chinese officials have been discussing, again, openly, you know, the Philippines probably belongs to us too. Yeah, and that's really what it was. It was just a discussion like that in the open. But the Chinese do know. I mean, the government doesn't jump on top of that and try and suppress it, because they know it scares the hell out of the, you know, the Westerners, which serves a purpose, obviously. The Western media obliges because it sells newspapers, as the old saying goes. So the Chinese Navy is scary, but it's not effective. That may eventually change, but not anytime soon.
Austin?
I agree with Jim's technical training analysis. I mean, it's just he's got an excellent grip on the problems that they have with the technology. Also, they, if you want to call them problems with quote unquote tradition, they're having to develop a tradition of training sailors to be able to operate not simply the systems on modern ships, but operate the ships in tandem or in a fleet, in fleet operations, and in conjunction with air. In other words, organizing and choreographing all of the components of modern naval operations under the sea, on the surface, in the air, and taking advantage of space assets as well as all the other sensor arrays. That's very complicated. That's part of what Jim means when he says, you know, they're developing these systems, but they're not ready for prime time. And where an example of prime time is what the United States Navy and the Japanese Navy, would say naval self-defense forces, are capable of, where they can integrate all of those sensor systems from the sea into the into outer space, share data, situational awareness with their own ships operating near them, be able to access the distant intelligence platforms, control fires. In other words, controlling fires doesn't mean that you're just shooting from your own sub or from your own frigate or your own aircraft, but you want to try to get the best piece of ordnance on the target. Now, of course, war doesn't work quite like that, but when you train for it and you build high-quality organizations, and here I'm talking about naval organizations, those elements are part of what you train to do, and the Chinese are not anywhere near it. And as Jim indicates, they know that. That said, the let's call it the sensationalist media. Is that a good term, Jim? Like this?
Pretty accurate. All media is sensationalist. If it's
All right. But you know what I mean by that. I mean, they're responding to, and the Chinese are very good at this, Dan. They're not the only ones good at it, but they're a good object lesson in being able to portray some of what they're doing to a moderately informed media, let's put it that way, that they have capabilities that they really don't have. And what Strategy Page is saying, oh, wait a minute, they know how to develop them, but they are years, perhaps decades away. Now, the thing is, though, everything's dynamic, Dan. If the Japanese and the United States, and I'm not trying to set up a war with U.S. Japan against China, but South Korea, Taiwan, Australia, Singapore, India, whatever, is that you have to continue to invest in sophisticated naval systems because it's very hard to build a navy. Building a navy is a 20 or 25 year project at a minimum. You got to continue to invest in it to keep those capabilities up. And what the Chinese have done, and this is something, this is the strategic consideration here. This is something we've all written about. I've had a couple of essays about this over the last 3 years, but the Chinese are indicating that they are going to spend the money. Now, that is something to take seriously. The other thing to take seriously, too, and that's when we talk about the air defense interception zone or interdiction zone, fiasco over the Senkaku, the Aiyu Islands, but that wasn't all. Remember, there was a Korean islet that the Chinese extended that into. Those are calculated political gambits to they have a domestic component, which Jim said, Chinese nationalism. They're playing off of resentment of World War II, primarily against the Japanese. I think some of the latest discussions with Taiwan are in part to try to get Taiwan to play a more pro-China, take a more pro-China political stance vis-a-vis some of the sovereignty claims. Actually, Taiwan does. And the old, as the Republic of China, they this is now going back almost three decades, and some of the initial moves the Chinese were making in the South China Sea, Republic of China said that those were part of China as well. So that was kind of lost in the shuffle, but go back and look at it. Taiwan was had... let's call it secondary or tertiary diplomatic support for what Beijing was saying about Chinese maritime claims in the South China Sea. Well, remember at one time, the Republic of China claimed it really was the Republic of China, and you know the communist Chinese government was illegitimate. That reflects that historical division. Well, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, Beijing and Taipei have had diplomatic discussions, and I thought, I wonder if some of this isn't sending another message to the Japanese, maybe even the Filipinos and the like, about Chinese sovereignty diplomacy. Maybe that's a way to put it. They've got enormous claims, really, all around China's periphery. Some are dormant, some become are more active, the South China Sea, but look, there's still unsettled issues with the Indians in the Himalayas. They claim they're going to solve them, and then they don't get solved. It's dynamic. But the long-term message, and I go back, I said the Chinese want to spend money on the Navy. Well, the long-term message is they're going to exercise claims, they're making claims throughout Asia, that we're back in the game. That's their message to their domestic audience. But at some level, you have to take that seriously. Now, is that military aggression? No. Could it evolve into that? Not necessarily, I should say. Could it evolve into something more? Absolutely.
Jim, how are the countries in the region reacting to China's
building up of their Navy?
Well, they're scared because there haven't been any Chinese warships on the high seas, you know, for as long as anybody out there can remember. The Chinese fleet basically disappeared around the time of World War One, actually earlier. But this is totally new, and people in the area, they do have a sort of a institutional memory that China is the local superpower who can sometimes, you know, just throw their weight around, be a bully, in effect. And that's what the Chinese are showing that they can do. Plus, the Chinese, again, to the locals, this is very familiar. In a typically Chinese way, they are coming at it sideways, which is what all their military philosophers, you know, counsel. Don't go directly, that's too expensive. You know, hit him sideways. So they had this tactic of not sending when they basically say declare that all foreign ships have to register or get permission to go into the South China Sea or to fish. They've already done this, and they've extended that to aircraft. Well, at sea, what they do is they don't send a warship in there to threaten you, because that might result in an American or, you know, South Korean, whatever, other warship coming in and challenging it and basically forcing the Chinese to either fight, which would be disastrous, or to back off, which would be disastrous. No win situation. But if they send Coast Guard ships and basically civilian ships, Chinese ships, which are basically drafted for this duty, and basically play bumper car with the ships, basically threaten, or as they've done with some of these disputed atolls, they simply put a barrier, you know, a chain, as it were, across the entrance. A lot of these atolls only have one entrance. And then station a patrol ship or just, you know, a Chinese, you know, fishing boat or whatever with orders for the boat to basically get in harm's way. I mean, it works for Greenpeace. Why not for China? And then it's the same tactic. You know, get in your face. Force you to be the aggressor. And it's working. And, you know, the locals say this is typical, classic Chinese, you know, way of going at things. And they basically, and the Chinese are known to have a reputation for persistence. So they'll keep at it until they get their way. And the only thing they understand is force. And for thousands of years, there was no force. I mean, nobody could stand up against them. Chinese would just basically push. And, you know, the death of a thousand, you know, cuts, as it were. But now, Japan and South Korea, especially Japan is increasing its budget. They're producing more what the Chinese consider, what anybody would consider, you know, offensive weapons. And they've said they're going to use them. So the neighbors of China are nervous and unfortunately for the Chinese, a lot of them are willing to fight, which could get interesting.
Austin, how do you see the reaction there in the Pacific Rim?
Well, I go back to what I said a few minutes ago. They see that China's going to spend the money on their Navy and military assets. I mean, go back and how I see it is you go back to the four modernizations that are suggested or sketched by Zhou Enlai and formulated clearly by Deng Xiaoping. We've addressed those. That's been Chinese policy now since arguably the late 1970s. And one of the four modernizations is the military. But going part and parcel of this is this isn't the same type of Chinese nationalism around the emperor, but a more modern Chinese nationalism is, and I'm not going to go on to all the components of that, but some of this is loyalty to the quote unquote Chinese state with its capital in Beijing. Part of this is to try to get past the many China's worry of warlordism and regionalism. So that is a component of what we'll call social and psychological and ideological state building being forwarded by the Chinese government. That's part of the modernization process, by the way, that again began, as I said, 35 years ago. The Asian neighbors see this. They understand that the sovereignty claims have that domestic function, but they have their domestic concerns as well, which is, hey, that's ours too, or we should share in this, or don't bully us. And let's take the Vietnamese as an example. The Vietnamese lost in the 1970s some as North Vietnam, it was still North Vietnam, some islands that the Chinese took. Excuse me, there was the big one was they were still South Vietnam, and the Chinese occupied it. But they were claimed by quote unquote both Vietnams, and Vietnam now still quote unquote claims those islets that the Chinese took. Then Vietnam fought a war with China, which was a big deal in 1979. It was one of the things that Deng Xiaoping saw how poorly equipped and led and organized the People's Liberation Army was. The Vietnamese, he was going to teach the Vietnamese a lesson. The Vietnamese taught the Chinese army a lesson. Well, the Vietnamese see China as imperialists and a threat to their own sovereignty. And I'm picking on them or using them. They're communists as well. Well, they're also Vietnamese nationalists. They see China as a historic threat. Now it is a strengthening threat. Philippines certainly sees that with the games they play over that well-named Mischief Reef. You've got Malaysia is in this as well. Malaysia has claims that are the Chinese counterclaims to areas in the South China Sea. The enmity between Japan and China is well understood, and the Japanese depredations in China in the 1930s and 40s are well documented. Sometimes to the embarrassment and shame of the Japanese, but it is true. Chinese use that as a stick to the Japanese, but it also has a national, emotional, impassionate response from the Chinese public. And by damn, those islands belong to us. Well, the Japanese, from their perspective, is, well, wait a minute. There are ways to settle disputes, but if we capitulate to Chinese threats and demands, they're just going to demand more. So they're there, and what has functionally happened, and this is something we've said before on Strategy Page, actually a number of people address this, is these disparate countries have slowly become, when I say functional allies, there you've got a developing alliance, and this is something we pointed out a long time ago, in one of our podcasts, between South Korea and Vietnam. The Vietnamese are interested in South Korean technology. They have traded off some high-level military officer, quote-unquote, training programs. Well, it's their senior officers get to in Vietnam, work with some of the senior officers in South Korea. And what goes on there is that they develop professional working relationships. The Chinese have paid attention to it, but the reason that the South Koreans agreed to it, the Vietnamese had been approaching them before, was that they said, you know, China doesn't do what it needs to do with North Korea. China, and if you're, and if China is also going around and being a bully in the, throughout the region. Well, guess what? We'll talk to the Vietnamese. And the Vietnamese still, even though they don't have the money to modernize, they've got a respected military force, and with some new communications gear and some new modern weapons, and they would be a problem for the Chinese. So there's pushback going on, and we can see the pushback. That's the response, Dan.
Okay. Well, it looks like we're it's going to be interesting to watch China as they continue to pour money into their naval forces and to develop that. And I'm sure we'll be visiting it again. So thank you this time, and we'll talk to you both next
time. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.